The headlines: the U.S. Congress formally certifies Joe Biden's Electoral College votes, clearing the way for him to become president on January the 20th. U.S. President Donald Trump pledges, quote, an orderly transition, despite his total disagreement with the presidential election outcome. And four people die amid chaotic scenes inside the U.S. Capitol after pro-Trump rioters stormed the building in a stunning bid to overturn his election defeat. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the U.S. Congress has certified Electoral College votes in the 2020 presidential election, paving the way for Joe Biden to take an oath as the 46th President of the United States.
The whole number of electors appointed to vote for President of the United States is 538. Within that whole number, a majority is 270. The votes for President of the United States are as follows. Joseph R. Biden, Jr. of the state of Delaware has received 306 votes. Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 232 votes.
The House of Representatives and the Senate in a joint session approved the results, putting an end to months of dispute and election fraud lawsuits by incumbent Donald Trump. This came after both chambers rejected two objections from Trump allies to overturn Biden's victories in Arizona and Pennsylvania following Congress's decision. Trump said he totally disagrees with the outcome of the election, but there will be an orderly transition of power on January the 20th. On Wednesday, the Congress went into recess when Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building in a bid to push lawmakers to overturn the election results. U.S. police say at least four people were killed after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump stormed Capitol Hill to prevent the certification of Electoral College votes for President-elect Joe Biden. According to the D.C. police, one woman succumbed to injuries after being shot by law enforcement. They say three other protesters died in medical emergencies. At least 52 people have so far been arrested. The D.C. police also say they've recovered two pipe bombs as the headquarters of Republican and Democratic National Committees. The unprecedented violence prompted Washington's mayor to extend the public emergency to 15 days until Biden's inauguration. Coinciding with riots on the Capitol building, pro-Trump protest rallies were held at state houses in several cities, including Los Angeles. Riot police made a number of arrests after the gathering outside L.A. City Hall turned violent. Sporadic clashes also broke out between Trump supporters and Black Lives Matter protesters there. A similar rally in the state of Salem, Massachusetts turned violent. In the capital of Oregon, pro-Trump protesters burned an effigy of the state's Democratic governor. At least one person was arrested. In Kansas, protesters entered the state house in Topeka and assembled on the first floor. Several government buildings in Denver and Atlanta were ordered closed due to protests near their state houses. Rallies were also held in a number of other state capitals, among them Little Rock, Tallahassee, and Santa Fe.
For the first time since their war with the English in 1814, the home of Congress, the United States Capitol building, was shockingly breached, but this time by Americans. Vote counting had just begun among the very unpopular Electoral College, the unelected body which chooses the United States president. Capitol security forces were unable to restrain supporters of President Donald Trump, who were peacefully protesting, but then some suddenly forced their way into the Capitol. They fought past cops, posed for selfies, and caused the elite body of voters to flee in gas masks. The Capitol was occupied until security forces enforced a sundown curfew, and Trump tweeted that protesters, quote, have to go home. On a day when Joe Biden was expected to be officially voted in as the next president of the United States, it was a shocking string of events with many different interpretations.
I think it's just a matter of, you know, reaction. The Trump supporters are basically, they want the, I guess, the classic America back, right? But the new America is very capitalistic, and it is very disconnected from emotions and history, and it's mostly profit-driven.
The controversy is the latest serious blow to the credibility of the American electoral system. Polls still show that nearly half of all voters view Biden's victory as illegitimate. Polls show that around 40% of the country believes that voter fraud swung the vote in Biden's favor, but those claims remain unproven, and the nation's top courts have sided with Biden.
It's really ridiculous. You know, the election was just. There was nothing out of the ordinary. It was one of the least corrupt elections in the history of the United States because people were aware that everything was under the magnifying glass. So this, it's hard to wrap your brain around how people cannot accept that.
Despite the incredible events of the day and the death inside the Capitol, once order was restored, the Electoral College resumed counting the votes, which were subject to highly unusual objections and extended debates. The question is, was this shocking protest just a one-time event, or will there be others? Whatever arrives next, the nation remains on edge, uncertain, and full of incredibly burning division. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Writer and journalist John White says supporters of outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump consider him an anti-establishment figure and a protector of their rights.
It's no surprise that Trump doesn't accept the result because he operates in a post-truth universe and always has, as do his followers. And my friend in Beijing is quite right that he is seen as the anti-establishment candidate after years of neoliberalism had created so much damage, created so much inequality and poverty, and caused so much havoc in people's lives. But they voted for him not on the basis of class, but on the basis of race. And when he said, "America, make America great again," the one word missing from that sentence, but which everybody knew he meant, was make white America great again. He has played to the fears of white working class people, especially in the Deep South and the Midwest, over a rising tide of black assertion, black pride. And the irony is that the Black Lives Matter protest movement and these protesters who've stormed the Capitol building have much more in common than they have to divide them on the basis of class, on the basis of their economic condition. Race has always been the way that the elites in the US have been able to rule over working class people on the basis of ethnic, cultural, racial differences.
Political analyst Jack Rasmus says there are strong indications police and National Guard in Washington, D.C. were in collusion with Trump as they failed to stop the unruly mob.
So there is a question, you know, why did 1,000 Capitol Police just do nothing? And why didn't D.C. police come around for at least 6 hours? You know, there were hours before they even got any help from anybody. So it was all very, very curious affair, you know. And I heard that Nancy Pelosi had talked with the chief of the Capitol Police, and he assured them. Assured her that no one would even get on the steps of the Capitol if they came. Because, you know, we knew this was going to happen. We knew there were going to be demonstrations there. But, you know, I think the Capitol Police let it get out of hand. And someone needs to answer for that. And it wouldn't have happened to the extent it did. But, you know, it backfired, as I said. It backfired on them. And now they're in even deeper trouble than they were in the very beginning here. And it's going to be interesting to see what Trump does in the next 72 hours, because he's really under attack now from the rest of the political elite that have closed ranks against him. He may not make it to January 20th.
Four former U.S. presidents have denounced the rioting by supporters of incumbent Donald Trump on the Capitol building. In a statement, Barack Obama described the attack as a moment of great dishonor and shame for America. He accused Trump of lying about the outcome of a lawful election. Former Republican President George W. Bush also drew a comparison between the incident and how election results are disputed in, quote, a banana republic. 42nd President Bill Clinton condemned what he called an unprecedented assault, blaming Trump for fueling riots. Jimmy Carter, the 39th American president, slammed the raid as a national tragedy. He called for a peaceful resolution that can help complete the transfer of power. President-elect Joe Biden also denounced the storming, calling for an end to the chaos.
This is not dissent. It's disorder. It's chaos. It borders on sedition, and it must end now.
Biden described the storming as an assault on U.S. democracy. Several officials and lawmakers have also denounced the incident. Vice President Mike Pence called for an immediate end to the demonstrations. Republican Senator Mitt Romney said Trump has caused what he called an insurrection. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy also called the protests un-American. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the storming of Capitol Hill in the U.S. shows the weakness and failure of Western democracy. Rouhani called outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump as a populist who, he said, ruined his country's reputation in the last 4 years. Rouhani said an unqualified person in power is very harmful not only to his nation, but to the world as a whole. He expressed hope that the world gets rid of all unwise leaders, urging the next U.S. government to follow the path of law and rationality. Other world leaders have also reacted to the storming of the Congress building in Washington, D.C.
In the eyes of the world, American democracy tonight appears under siege. This is an unseen assault on the U.S. democracy, its institutions, and the rule of law. This is not America. The election results of the 3rd of November must be fully respected.
Disgraceful scenes in U.S. Congress. The United States stands for democracy around the world, and it is now vital that there should be a peaceful and orderly transfer of power.
The violent acts against American institutions are a grave attack against democracy. I condemn them. The American people's will and vote must be respected.
Shocking scenes in Washington, D.C. The outcome of this democratic election must be respected.
Deeply concerned by violence at the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and the interruption of the democratic process in the UN's host country.
Iran has once again pledged to avenge the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was killed in a terror attack in November. Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Mohammad Baghdadi, said Iran will retaliate at the proper time and place. He underlined that the U.S. and Israeli regimes were plotting to assassinate Fakhrizadeh for 2 decades. Baghdadi made the comments during a ceremony marking the 40th day of the martyrdom of Fakhrizadeh. He hailed character, knowledge, and dedication of the slain scientist. The general noted that the country's youth would continue his legacy and the path of progress. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a terrorist attack near Tehran. He was deputy defense minister and head of the Ministry's Organization for Defensive Innovation and Research. Political analyst Alexander Ozadegan says Iran's enemies are hoping officials won't react to the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh.
The worst thing that Iran could do is do nothing. I think the enemies of Iran are banking on that because they feel they have cornered Iran into such a vicious place that if Iran reacts, it's going to be punished. If it doesn't react, it's going to make itself prone to future attacks like this. I think at the heart of this is to bring Iran back into what they call the negotiation table. I think policymakers in Brussels, and it's not just in Washington, in Brussels as well, they need to realize there will be no negotiations needed to restore the Iranian nuclear deal. Washington, under whatever president, can't just come in and go. into international treaties and expect the world to hold its breath. Negotiations were over in July of 2015. Iran should not negotiate over the same real estate twice, as your foreign minister has been saying repeatedly since 2018. And besides, negotiations were over Iran's nuclear issue, not over Iran's foreign policy in the region or outside the region, or Iran's deterrent missile program, or any other issue other than the nuclear issues.
Residents of Syrian capital's countryside have come together to commemorate the first martyrdom anniversary of Iranian top commander General Qasem Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq last year. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali has more in this report.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat, and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country.
We have gathered here to honor the memory of Commander Soleimani, who offered Syria valuable services. General Soleimani is a historic hero whose achievements changed the region.
A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus countryside.
Police in Myanmar say they've arrested a large group of Rohingya Muslims being trafficked from the country's violence-ridden Rakhine state. Police said nearly 100 people were found during a raid after authorities were alerted of a suspicious man in Shwipeta township. The majority of them were said to be women accompanied by young children. Local authorities said the discovered Rohingya were headed to Malaysia as part of a trafficking network. Members of the stateless minority group have long faced discrimination in Myanmar. They've been denied freedom of movement and citizenship and lack access to work, health care, and schools. Nearly a million of them crossed into neighboring Bangladesh after Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown in 2017. The UN has described the plight of Rohingya as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing those who feel the fire burning. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. He's also a program advisor for the BFI London Film Festival. And Nassim Ahmed, who is a political analyst and writer for Middle East Monitor. Now, Those Who Feel the Fire Burning, directed and written by Morgan Kanibe, is an unconventional, artistic, and powerful documentary about the refugee crisis. The film shows the level of poverty, humiliation, and other afflictions the refugees have to endure as they are stuck in a hopeless situation on the borders of Europe. Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, that was a very emotional documentary. Lee, if I can start with you first. Now, there's been a wave of documentaries about the refugee crisis. What makes this documentary so unique and different?
Well, I think the first question is it even a straight documentary? I mean, definitions are very fluid, but I would term it an essay film, which is a film that kind of blurs the lines between fiction and documentary and is often operating in a kind of very sort of meditative or contemplative tone with a sort of very, you know, focused first-person thing. And what they do in this film with this kind of free-floating, you know, disembodied point of view is...
You're sort of a wandering ghost, aren't you?
You're a ghost, yeah. At the beginning there's a very harrowing shipwreck, and it's as if one of the people who didn't make it from that crossing is now sort of wandering as a sort of spirit around Europe and sort of encountering various, refugees and sort of experiencing a little bit of each of their stories. So in that sense, it's very unconventional, but very striking as a result.
Mm-hmm. And Nassim, if I could go to you next. What was your take on Those Who Feel the Fire Burning?
When I first watched it, and I agree with Lee, I mean, it's very immersive. It really takes you into the life of a refugee and their experiences, but there isn't a grand narrative. Most documentaries, as we know, they have a clear idea as to where they're going, and you get a sense of what the problem is, what the issues are, mm-hmm. and even maybe, you know, recommend some solutions to those problems. That's usually the format of a documentary. But here you're left with lots of questions, background questions as to where they're from, you know, who are these people? I mean, we know they're refugees, but where are they from? What's their story? Why is this person taking drugs? So it immerses you into their experiences, but leaves me lots and lots of questions about their background and stuff like that.
And that's exactly what I would like to actually ask you about while you're here, to give some context to this situation. Now, this documentary was made a few years ago, but the refugee crisis is still ongoing. So would you say that this documentary will stay relevant for years to come?
I think the experiences of these refugees will be relevant for a long, long time, because these are shared experiences. These are people who have left their homes, and this is a shared experience throughout the world. Anyone who leaves their homes to a different land, they will face this kind of subjugations, and they will be living on the margins of society. That's how most refugees live. So from an emotional perspective, from this visceral connection which you have with refugees, I think that would stay with you as a form of art for many, many years to come. But in terms of providing context and information about the real issues about facing refugees in Europe, I don't think it really touches on those issues much. Like, for example, 5 million refugees coming from Syria, and how that's affecting the socio-political climate within Europe, how that's changing the demography within Europe, and the insecurities it's creating, the political turmoil it's led to. So those kind of questions is not even addressed by the documentary. But in terms of, as I said, as a program which touches on the feelings and the emotions of refugees, I think it will stay with us for a long, long time.
Lee, would you have liked to have seen that, some more political context, some sort of the questions raised while watching this documentary?
It's a tricky one, because on one hand, I really admire the sort of artistry and you know, trying to frame a film about this subject in an entirely different way. It's much more like a sort of Terrence Malick film, you know, with the sort of free-flowing narration. You don't even know who's talking sometimes, or it's not necessarily connected to most traditional feature or documentary films about refugees. You follow a small number of protagonists, mm-hmm. and like you say, there's a clear, we're here, we need to get to here, and this is the goal. And so they follow a very sort of traditional narrative thing. Michael Winterbottom's In This World, or Diego Quiroga Diaz's The Golden Dream. You know who these people are, and so it's the film's counting on you to empathize with and then put yourself in the place of those characters. Because this film is doing this much more sort of free-floating, sort of collage-type thing, it maybe loses that direct connection. It's trying to put you in the point of view of someone you don't ever see.
Yes.
And so therefore, that sort of, you know, empathy that we traditionally get in films of, that's our character, how would I react in that situation? It's not trying to do that. So it loses the sort of specifics that Nazima, and you know, where are we? How long have they been there? All of these facts and sort of details are, you know, deliberately omitted, but it's much more after a sort of experiential type thing. And, you know, there are pros and cons to that approach. I find it very interesting as a film, but if I was studying, you know, if I was trying to understand the refugee crisis in Europe from this film, I'd be left, as Nazim says, with a lot more questions than I had at the beginning.
Well, there's some really great, interesting points that you made. But I have to say, I really love the transitions between places we see. I think it's quite beautiful. And Lee, we see a refugee child there. What kind of conditions do we see them exposed to in this documentary?
Oh, it's horrific. I mean, it's, you know, and, you know, what it's showing there is what we've seen so many times also in the news, you know, horrendous scenes of children. Because those are, you know, as much as your heart goes out to anybody in those situations, when it's children who obviously have no concept of the wider, you know, implications and ramifications of what's going on, it's horrific. I mean, from what I've read, the UNHCR website talks about like over 65 million displaced people, over 22 million refugees like that right now, and over 50% of those are under 18. So you mm-hmm. see the sort of the scale of the tragedy that's affecting everybody, but a very big preponderance of young people, including kids. And it's horrible. I mean, I have a daughter myself. The idea that your young family could be in anything like the situation that we see some of these individuals in is just, it's almost unimaginable. But yet, it's happening right now, you know, countries not very far away from us.
And I think you're right in saying that, and children are bearing the brunt of this crisis. And Nassim, can you shed more light on this? I mean, what other conditions are they exposed to, and what other hardships do they have to endure?
Well, we get a perspective from a doctor I met who was actually going in and out of the refugee camps in Greece. And he was saying, I mean, some basic things like dental health, for example, it's leading to a situation where you have young children who have no access to dental health. So he goes and provides, an NGO which he belongs to, goes and provides provisions for dental health. And it's like 65% of those, we think it's a minor issue, you know, but all of us know what it feels like when your teeth is aching and it's one of the worst pains you can imagine. Mm. And he's saying young children, you know, facing massive dental problems within these refugee camps. But that's just one example of many of the basic health issues which are lacking in those refugee
camps.
There's
also the issue of child exploitation, sex trafficking.
That goes without saying. You know, we've had reports after reports which the UN publishes and also EU publishes of child exploitation. And the other day we had a report which showed that refugees on the boats, they were actually forced to jump off, and 50 led to 50 actually dying. So these smugglers, as they were being caught, you know, they forced the refugees to come off the boats. So you hear horrific stories like that, and we see that every single day. But in terms of the real situation on the ground, I think many of them have said that they would rather have not made the trip to Europe and have seen that they're actually stuck in refugee camps with no chance of having any kind of asylum or entry into the country. So
it's interesting that you say that. And Nassim, I want to pick up on a point you made just before we went to the clip, about how the refugees thought that going to Europe would be the hardest part, but in fact it's the easiest part. Do you think people would be surprised to know this?
I think even our personal experiences, people I've met as well, they say that once they're here, they expect certain level of, you know, certain conditions, certain living standards, and those expectations are not met. And many of them have been stranded, as I said, in camps, some living on streets, hoping that their, you know, lives will improve. But that's the dreams have not really materialized. It's not really dreams, it's basic expectations which they came to Europe for. So we see that, you know, on the streets as well, refugees trying to make a living cleaning windows. You know, these are people who are struggling, you know, they're not being processed properly by the system. Mm-hmm. So we don't know how many of them will actually get any kind of asylum here in the UK. Many in the Scandinavian countries, as Czech Republic, for example, they're actually paying some of the refugees because of their own personal political situations, the far right, you know, getting more and more support. They are actually paying refugees to leave their countries because of their own political situation. The far right thriving in support. So refugees themselves, they said, you know, it's much, much harder now, and they would prefer to have actually not made the journey. We hear that from refugees in Syria. Not to mean that they're all facing this kind of situation. Most refugees would still prefer to live here in Europe, trying for asylum, because situations in Syria, in Afghanistan, those war-torn countries which have been bombarded for the last decade or so, they'd rather be in this situation where they at least have an opportunity to find some kind of a better living condition than face the bombs and the barrel bombs in Syria or in Afghanistan or other parts of the world as well.
And Lee, I want to bring you in on here. So we see after that perilous journey a refugee makes, you would think there would be some relief at the end. What was your reaction to this scene?
I mean, I think the entire sort of thesis, if you like, of the film is that these people are in purgatory. So you get this disembodied ghost. And
That's
trailer that you showed at the beginning is like, you know, is this heaven? Is this paradise? And it's like, well, if it's not hell, which it could well be, and you see some of the horrendous situations they're living in, it's certainly this limbo. So they are stuck. They're not, you know, they're not citizens now of any country. They're not being looked after where they are. They can't go back to where they came from. And for me, one of the most nerve-wracking scenes I've seen in any film recently was just after the clip that we showed there, where there's the men trying to climb up the huge chains that are moored to the ship to try and get up. And you see this guy going up, and because it's not, you know, Tom Cruise outside an airplane, you know he's safe. But I had no idea if this man was going to make it. And he's very high up. He's really struggling to reach the ship. And it's absolutely nerve-wracking to watch. And you just realize the desperation that you must be, A, to have left your country in the first place, and then still to be trying these very, very sort of risky ways to still, you know, get further away from where you see the danger. So it's really that what brought it home to me is the desperation and also just the limbo that these people find themselves in, which is heartbreaking.
I think that's a really perfect analogy to describe it as a sense of purgatory, and that the struggle's not over. They're neither here nor there. Lee, you were just talking about purgatory, but death is a very harsh reality that the refugees face almost on a constant basis. What did you feel watching this scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because my understanding is that entire sequence is from a short film that Morgan Knibbe made before Those Who Feel the Fire Burning called Shipwreck, and he's literally just put the whole thing in there. And I think there's even clips from a student film he made in Greece. So he's obviously dedicated a huge amount of his time and energy to putting to this issue. And so to put it all together like this, you know, I don't find the film exploitative, but there's one shot, we didn't show it in that clip, but it's from that same sequence where you just see all these Western journalists and people holding up their cameras and looking into it. And I really got a sense of, like, that's kind of us in a way, because, you know, the average citizen of a European country, we see these images, it's so easy to get inured to them and sort of almost numb to what the reality of, you know, the individual stories. And yet we're constantly fed them.
But
and
we're desensitized.
Yeah, it's this weird sort of, not parasitic per se, but it's this weird relationship where we're constantly, you know, people are desperate to get that next shot. You know, some of the horrendous images we've seen of the young boy who drowned at sea, or the young boy sitting in the back of the ambulance covered in sort of soot. I mean, they stay with us, but at the same time, it's like, well, is it actually doing anything to make us change our attitude, or, you know, more importantly, the governments of these countries to change their attitude? And that's a really debatable question. I mean, I think the very fact that, you know, a young Dutch filmmaker has spent that amount of time trying to address this issue in a different way is a positive thing. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the change is going to come from, you know, legislation and governments, you know, changing their ideas. And that's, as always, is the big sticking point, I think.
And Nassim, I want to throw that question at you, actually. Does that resonate with you? I mean, what responsibility do journalists, people in the media have when it comes to covering the refugee crisis?
I mean, that very scene, the first question that came to my mind was, it seems there's a sense of voyeuristic, you know, the cameras, the lenses pointing at the woman crying. Her suffering, for me, in a sense, if you sit within the broader European context, it just seemed there was a disconnect there, because Europe here, the cameraman and the journalists are using this to actually feed a wider anti-refugee, anti-Islamophobic rhetoric that's taking place in Europe at the moment. So for me, they were not using the word exploitation, but I think it was in a sense being exploitative, not the director per se, but the other journalists, because they were using this to show that we are somehow being taken over by these immigrants, these refugees, and we know refugee has shifted politics, not just here in the UK with the Brexit and also in Europe as well, the rise of the far right, and this is all on the back of the refugee crisis. So those shots, those clips, which we really empathise with, those clips which really give us a sense of what it really feels like to be a refugee and the hardships they face, but they are being exploited to actually show a different narrative to the average person here on the streets in Europe, so that, you know, we are being overrun by refugees, our country is being changed, our culture is being taken over.
Is Europe dealing with the crisis very well?
From a narrative point of view, I don't think it is, because it's showing that somehow, you know, the non-Europeans, Muslims in particular, they're taking over the country, which is statistically, it's just completely wrong. It makes no sense whatsoever. 5% of Europeans are Muslims, which is, if you live for another century, the demography will not change much. But I think the rise of the far right is something that's very real, and it's taking place here, not just in Europe, in America, but it's around the world. You know, you see the rise of the far right, and they're exploiting the refugees as the main, you know, main bandwagon. It's something which they're using to actually push this narrative that we are taken over by Muslims, and which really isn't true. And this kind of movie, hopefully, maybe it might stem the tide of people's emotions and senses as to where, you know, what the real problem is. The problem isn't Muslims coming over. The problem is there's wars in Europe which Europeans have actually helped in supporting. Like the Britain is still paying money to the Saudis, and also
it's really interesting that provoked that kind of reaction watching this documentary for you, but I suppose the documentary doesn't address that point so much. But final 20 seconds to you, Lee, what message does this documentary leave you feeling?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it, even though it's doing it in an unconventional way, it is still very much trying to connect you, the viewer, and probably a Western viewer, to the plight of people from other places who are going through incredible suffering. The fact he's doing it in a more overtly artistic and sort of aestheticized way, then it's debatable whether we get to grips with the facts, but as a sort of a piece of filmmaking, you know, I think it's very valid to try that different approach, but it comes with its pros and its cons.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining the Doc Review sofa. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام صلاة الجمعة فريضة والاجتماع إليها فريضة مع الإمام فإن ترك رجل من غير علة ثلاث جمع فقد ترك ثلاث فرائض ولا يدع ثلاث فرائض من غير علة إلا منافق.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The Friday prayer is an obligation, and congregating for it in the presence of an imam is an obligation. So if someone misses three Friday prayers without an excuse, it is as if he has abandoned the performance of three obligations, and none but a hypocrite abandons three obligations without an excuse."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing and an honor to have you with us on the program. Now you're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the historical text a beautiful and profound conversation between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam Baqir alayhi salam. And truly it is a conversation which is quite long, but when you take it bit by bit, it is a conversation truly worth listening to. It's very interesting, but in this conversation, which is relatively long, we find that there are beautiful and important and valuable moral lessons and spiritual wisdoms given to Jabir al-Jufi by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now, in one of the places, Imam al-Baqir says, "There is no light better than the light of certitude, yaqeen. And there is no certitude, yaqeen, like your belittling the world." Allahu Akbar. In this conversation, truly, we find these amazing pieces of spiritual and moral advice that truly can alter our lives and make our lives better. Here, Imam al-Baqir, in this one little part of this long conversation, is telling us that there is no light like the light of certitude. Now, certitude, yaqeen, is this level of faith that a person has. For example, certitude in the oneness of Allah, or certitude in Allah being our creator, certitude in Allah giving us our sustenance, certitude that Allah will help us, certitude in the trust of Allah in all of our affairs, certitude that the righteous will prevail and falsehood and the followers of falsehood will surely fail. And so what does light do? Light is guidance. And so when we have certitude, yaqeen, in all these different fields, It will guide the path for us. It will be a light, and there is no better light than the light of certitude. And then to complete the thought process, Imam al-Baqir says to remember that there is no certitude, there is no yaqeen better than belittling the world. Now, when he talks about the world, he's talking about the materialistic world, this materialistic wealth, this materialistic fame and glamour, status and position, economic status, social status. These things should be belittled because truly they don't have any worth in the eyes of Allah. They have no worth in Islam. Islam and Allah considers what to be valuable? Honesty, sincerity, faith, trustworthiness, to be helpful to people, to be of service to humanity. These things is what is important. And so again, Imam al-Baqir says, there is no light like the light of certitude, and there is no certitude better than belittling this materialistic world. Beautiful words exchanged between Jabir al-Jufi and the amazing Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Now, when we look at the mawa'idh of Imam, salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi, we come to learn, Imam alayhi salam has said, وَتَسْوِلَ مَنْ قَطَعَكْ. Someone doesn't visit you, doesn't call you, doesn't text you, Facebook you, and so on and so forth. But here, Imam alayhi salam say, you have to do the opposite. They don't WhatsApp you, you WhatsApp them. They don't Facebook you, you Facebook them. I don't know if that's right. However, you do that, yeah? They don't communicate with you, you communicate with them. They don't visit you, visit them. They excommunicate you, don't do that. He says you have to visit them. It's not easy. Within our family members we see sometimes, we don't speak to one another. And you say, if I die, don't come to bury me. Imam alayhi salam says, no, you go visit them. This is among the makarimi dunya wal akhirah. Number three, he says, watahalum. إِذَا جُهِلَ عَلَيْكَ. When you go a place and people ignore you, they ignore you, جَهُلَ عَلَيْكَ. They pretend as if they don't know you. Be patient. Don't react as if it's the end of the world. Be patient. If you practice these three pillars of akhlaq, then you will be among the people of akhlaq.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.